Well, tell me a little bit about yourself and your background. You're a New Englander, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I grew up in North Tewksbury, Massachusetts, which is in between Lowell and Andover. And it's a small town that in those days there are a few cornfields here and there, but nowadays it's all developments of housing everywhere I look when I go back. So things have changed, yeah.
So geographically, you put much of your novel Extraordinary People in the area where you lived and grew up.
Yes, most of the book is set there, but there's a bit at the end, I think it's about a third, I suppose, that takes place in Italy. And
which is also where you're living.
I live now in Italy, yes. Yeah, I do. And have for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was inevitable that creep in, I suppose, toward the end.
Of course, some of it is set, a lot of it is set in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Lowell is the town where my father came from. And he had his business there. He had a liquor business. And I went to school. I went to grammar school at a Catholic grammar school in Lowell. So I know Lowell, and Lowell seems to be, while North Tewksbury was a small town, Lowell was the little, slightly bigger city next to it. So we felt almost like we were in the suburbs of that small city. A mill city, which I think I describe in the book as it peaked, its economic period peaked during Grover Cleveland's administration. But since then, I think they've had another renaissance with Wang Corporation. And
now we're talking about Lowell.
Pulled out of it. Lowell, yeah.
It seems to me I read something not too long ago where some of the old factories that had been shut down had been changed into, I could be wrong about this, but they had changed it into more of a tourist area with shops and things like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's the first, I think I have this right, but I think it's the first urban national park in America. And so what they've done is they've brought back some of the old mills because these were the first and most important mills in the Industrial Revolution in America. And they've brought them back with exhibits of the textile industry, which is what made its money. So you can do that, and you can take little trolleys through, and there are guides who explain what's happening or what happened in those days. There are exhibits to look at. It's interesting, mm-hmm. And it's a new concept, I suppose, for the National Park Services.
Have you ever been to Paterson, New Jersey?
I never have, no.
Well, that's kind of similar, too, because they have a waterfall in the middle that was used for generating electricity for mm-hmm. some early mills. And, of course, those mills are no longer functional, but they are open. You can tour them and things like that to mm-hmm. see the image of a 19th century factory town there. So I have a feeling Lowell is very much like that.
Yeah, I think
probably
it is.
More so, in fact.
And also Paterson inspired literature too, didn't it?
Well, I believe it's Roy Carlos Williams came from Paterson, New Jersey.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who did Lowell? Is Lowell named after the Lowells?
Well, in the extended family of Lowells, I should think. Yes. Jack Kerouac was born in Lowell and grew up in Lowell and left it quickly. Who else of writers? Of writers, I can't think of others at the moment.
Lowell was French-Canadian, and Gervais, is that French-Canadian as well?
Yes, it is. Lowell seemed to attract all people from all nations, and there were French-Canadians there, and still are, I should think, Irish people, a good population of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans, and now Puerto Ricans and people from Latino peoples have come there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was essentially big Irish population. My background, though I have a French name, is not particularly French. It was actually, that's the name of my father's stepfather. So I have, my background is much more Anglo-Irish.
The same sort of name switches appear in the book. There must be an awful lot of autobiographical elements in Extraordinary People.
I wouldn't deny that there are, no. It's based on and inspired by my own family. Though it's very fictionalized. There's a story, for example, in which Sam, who is the young narrator, who might be, I think at the time, 10 years old, goes to a summer resort with his family on the on the shores of Lake Winnipesaukee. And what takes place in that story is totally fiction, as are many of the things that happen in the book. But essentially, the characters are based on my own family.
That was a wonderful, that was probably my favorite chapter, because there you could see the differences in the two families. You have one family with the handsome mother and father and the three strapping children who seem to be all but perfect. And contrast that with Sam's family in the book, with all of the myriad problems that they had.
Yes, there is a family who was living along the shore, who had a very nice house, and they were clearly from a better background, let's say, or at least from a background that Sam, who at 10 years old, admired very much, because his own family behaved in quite a different way. They loved to party. In fact, they had good friends with them who were staying there at the resort at the time. And every night was a big party in their rented cottage with lots of drinking and storytelling and carrying on. Never a quiet moment. And Meg, the mother, who is a beautiful woman from Connecticut who loves to enjoy herself in a jazzy sort of way, might be misplaced maybe in that family and with her husband, who is relatively religious and Catholic, realizes that they've run out of ice. They're having a nice party and a nice time, and she's run out of ice. And they say to her, why don't you go down to that house where those people live and see if you can borrow a tray of ice from them? I'm sure they never use it. So, of course, down she goes with her son Sam in tow, who doesn't like the idea of going there at all for such a thing, because he understands they're so different from his own family. But they do, and they go there. And Meg borrows a tray of ice. And while she's getting that there, Sam sees one of the sons, who might be his age or slightly older, lying on a couch reading a book. And Sam wonders, what is this book about and what could possibly be in it? Because no one ever read books in his family, and it's nothing that he knew anything about. So he leaves there thinking about how much he would like to change places with that boy and be adopted by that family, give up his own identity completely, leave his own family behind, and join up with that family. But, of course, this is impossible. Toward the end of the trip, they're having their last party. It's the last evening, and Meg realizes that she has not returned the ice tray to the people down below. And she says, oh, I really should do that. So she fills the ice tray with water. They're all quite drunk at this point and having a wild time. Fills the ice tray with water and turns around to the group and says, I thought I'd be nice and return it to them full, which, of course, everyone finds incredibly amusing, and they have bongo drums and they're banging on it and thinking, isn't that great, Meg? Yes, you've got to go and do that. They'll get a big kick out of it. So she says, come on, Sam, you're going to. Well, Sam, of course, hates the idea of having to do such a thing, and he's forced into it, and it's a bit of a humiliating prospect to him. And down he goes, down the hill under the pine trees, and they go to that house. And, of course, the whole family is there having a proper dinner with their cloth napkins in their hands when they come to the door to see what this is all about. And Meg walks in with her ice tray, and she says, here it is, I thought I'd return it to you full. And, of course, no one gets it. This is a very stern family, and Sam's eyes scan the eyes of these stern people who just didn't get the joke, because it didn't belong in that household. It only belonged in his own household. And he tries to laugh and encourage them to laugh, because he wants them to get it, of course. But at the same time, he's just terribly embarrassed and humiliated by his mother, who's quite intoxicated in her antics. So they leave the house, and they're walking up the hillside, and Meg stops for a moment, and she's a bit sobered up by the experience, and she sits down on a rock, and she says to Sam, you know, sometimes, Sam, when you look at me, it's like you think I'm an old hag. And Sam is a bit touched by this, and this is where he realizes that even though he'd only done it in his dreams, he'd abandoned his own family, and he wished that he hadn't, and that he really loved his parents and his family.
Well, I think that's very common, though. I think all of us look upon our own families with a certain degree of embarrassment. And the family down the block just seemed so much better.
Yeah.
And yet, but I would imagine the roles might well be reversed. The family that seems so much better down the block is having its own problems and sees another family superior to it.
No doubt. And when Sam adjusts to the fact that, yes, he does love his family and he really didn't want to leave them, not even in his dreams, when that other family drives away and he sees the towhead boys in the back seat with their neat luggage piled in the windows, and they drive off and it's the end of their vacation, and he thinks about the fact that probably those kids will be coming back to that same place every year, even when they're grown up and they have their own children. And Sam feels still a little bit of regret to be left behind.
Well, alcoholism, Meg, of course, in the book, has a major drinking problem. Tell me a little bit about the influences alcohol played perhaps in your own family's life and how it reflected itself in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, Meg, being dissatisfied perhaps mostly with her relationship with her husband, not because she didn't love him in her way and in many ways, but because he was not there. He was a person who was very distracted, as I think many men in family situations can be. He was much happier to be hidden behind his newspaper, or to be off playing golf, or to take the evening shift at his liquor store, which he often did, so that he wasn't at home in the evenings at all. And Meg, who would have been happy to have spent every night out at a party, was there at home having to make dinner for the children. And the children were merely children, and of course she didn't have the kind of rapport she would have had with them. She would have had with her own friends, or they were just the children in her home. So she took to drinking, and she was a secret drinker, Meg, in the book, and she often has her shot glass of whiskey hidden behind the ivory liquid in the kitchen, as apparently a lot of people do. Someone read this book recently and said to me, "But tell me, Meg isn't really an alcoholic, is she? I mean, sure, she kept her glass of whiskey hidden behind the ivory liquid and that sort of thing. But we all did that. I mean, everyone I knew did that." And I suppose there is a milieu of people out there who might think of that as just normal behavior. Meg doesn't think of herself as an alcoholic. And
few alcoholics do.
And perhaps few do, yes. And really, it's a term that's never very clear, is it? Because there are all kinds of dependencies on alcohol. But it's a very difficult thing, I think, for a child to grow up with an alcoholic parent, and probably especially an alcoholic mother. Fathers are usually off at work all day doing business. They're not the ones who are touching the children all day long. They're not the ones who are caring for them. But when it's your mother and when she has a drinking problem, the schizophrenia especially can be very damaging to a child.
Now, Cliff's drift into homosexuality. There was a lot of signs, for example, his dressing up in the role of the part in The King and I. But could that be traced directly, do you suppose, to the sexual assault that he underwent?
No, I don't think so. I think that there are certainly a lot of people who think that tendency towards homosexuality might even be genetic. I know some homosexuals who feel that way. Though it might be the result or the effect of certain conditions in a household, perhaps the absence of a father who lends the child a strong male image or fatherly image. Cliff was, right from the beginning of the book, he's referred to as a mama's boy. He was much happier in the warmth of his mother's attention and really didn't care for his father very much. So that when Cliff is molested, the circumstances that bring him there were already existing. There's a bit of ambiguity about that story, that part of the book in which Cliff, who has a tendency to leave his brother, abandon his brother in town when they go to town and go off looking for things that his younger brother Sam doesn't understand. This is when Cliff is about 13 years old, perhaps. And Cliff does go off looking for things, and it's said there in the book that he is looking for things that might be exactly that, some sort of sexual experience. he was dealing with the mystery of his sexuality at that point.
Of course, it's not as clear with regard to Sam, mostly, I guess, because Sam is in many instances the narrator of the story. But it does appear that Cliff and Sam, in terms of their homosexuality, led parallel lives.
They led parallel lives, but they are very different characters. And an example of that might be the fact that Sam had a great deal of time coping with his mother's alcohol. And his tendency was to escape from the situation. He, in fact, ultimately moves away. He moved to California to study oenology, which is the wine science. And then he moved to Italy, where he took a job as an oenologist on a farm. Where Cliff was happy and comfortable to stay close to his mother. In fact, he bought her clothes. He bought her outfits. He in fact made her style in many ways and put her into the style that he himself might have used had he been a woman, as it says in the book at one point. So he was very comfortable with his mother and her drinking problem. He could adjust to it. He even drank with her. He enjoyed evenings with her. He brought her into his own social life. Sam would never have done that.
In fact, he did have a rather awkward relationship with her, personified, I think, best in the chapter in which she goes to visit in Italy.
Yes, by then, Meg is suffering from acute senile dementia, which is coming on very strongly. And Meg has always, in that chapter, I think there's a line that says, Sam is much happier now that he can. Meg has a tendency to say embarrassing things. She, for example, once visited a friend of Sam's who lived in a very beautiful house in Magnolia by the Sea. And Dana is the fellow's name. And Meg looked the place over and said to Dana, "Ah, rich bitch, huh?" And Sam, of course, found this quite embarrassing. And it was the only time he ever saw his friend Dana blush. But he says that he's much happier now with Meg senile and demented, that there is... One can blame these strange remarks on her disease and that they are now merely symptoms. So he's comfortable with that idea.
Well, with homosexuality, a theme of your book, it's no surprise that AIDS also plays a role. And isn't it shocking when you pick up the newspaper and you see so-and-so 30, so-and-so 40, so-and-so 50, and... You can tell almost immediately that AIDS was the cause. Yeah. It's an absolutely shocking disease.
Mm-hmm. I've never in my life read obituaries until these last few years because I go to them and I see all these wonderfully talented people who are dying so fast. And I read those ages and I read their little resumes and see what they've done and think about what they might have done had they lived. It's very sad, yeah.
What's it like with regard to AIDS in Europe, especially Italy, where you're living now?
In Italy, most of the people who are HIV positive are drug users and not so often homosexuals. Oddly enough, it's a slightly different situation. But there's a lot of publicity about it. We see it in the papers. There are... safe sex information is widely dispersed in drugstores. Now in supermarkets, in fact, where in America, when you check out at the supermarket and there is, chewing gum? In Europe, there are condoms.
Right, by the cash. Even in Catholic Italy, huh?
By the cash register. Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, it would be a digression maybe to talk about the difference between the behavior of Catholic Italians versus those of American Catholics, because abortion is never an issue in Italy. It's not discussed very widely. There would never be a demonstration against it. Choice is much more taken for granted than the freedom of choice under the Pope there in Italy, so close to the Vatican, than it would ever be in America. Americans have a very different mentality about morals.
I think it goes to our repressed Victorian background to a degree. Mm. How did it happen that you moved to Italy?
I think I was born with a need to live in Europe for some reason. All my life I'd wanted to live in Europe. whatever I'd known of it or learned through seeing European films, always told me that I had to be there and that I belonged there. And I probably do, though I love New York and I love America and I love being here. I think I'm much more European by nature, and so I'm very comfortable there. And I went there and, on a trip and visited someone in a town called Lucca in Tuscany, and I found it a very beautiful place. And I went back a year later with my friend Gil, with whom I've lived for 18 years. And we bought a house, and we've been there for 10 years. And it's a wonderful life.
Tell me about the house.
It's a villa from the Renaissance, 16th century. And it sits on 60 acres of land, and we make wine, and that's what inspired this character who's an enologist. I'm not an enologist. I know very little about it. But we do make wine and olive oil. And it's a beautiful old house that is quite charming.
How do you finance this? Through the olive oil and the wine?
Well, it brings in a certain kind of revenue, yeah. It certainly doesn't, without getting into personal things, it doesn't really carry itself. Other income has to take care of it.
Well, let's go back a little bit. How did it happen that you began to write and to create these stories that eventually became... Actually, they were written as individual stories, weren't they?
They were, though. I intended that they be put together in a novel. We're seeing a great deal of this format now, I think, in new, especially new American writing. I began to write them as stories, though I intended to fit them together in one piece that would be chronological and that would involve only those characters. So I really did have a novel in mind, even though they happened to come out, the chapters happened to come out in the stories of, in the form of stories. I'd been writing really since I was a child, though I turned away from it because I found it that I wasn't in the right situation. I had too many other things to do, like try to make a living, for example. And then when I got to Italy and had a bit of freedom, I felt that I had the time to devote to it. And I began working at it full-time, and now I am a full-time writer, and this is what I do.
So you really got off to a rather late start, huh?
Yes, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Though I, in fact, my idol is Harriet Dorr, who published her first book at the age of 71 or 2, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I think she began writing much, much earlier, but I think she had this great success. Well, I can't remember the title of the book.
Stones for Ibarra.
That was an earlier one.
No, that's her first published book.
Was that her first one?
Yeah, a very beautiful book too. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people who started very late. Henry Miller published his first novel, I think, at the age of 41. It's not that uncommon.
Of course, when we say late, you're not really that old.
Well, no, thank you, no.
But some people start, incredibly in their early 20s, and you just... They must be extremely intelligent people to have successfully published perceptive books at that early age, because most of us at that age can barely sign our names.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
It's hard enough to get through a term paper in college, you know.
True.
Try to think of creating a work of imagination as a young person. That's tough.
It's true. And I think that's why so much attention of the media goes to these younger writers, because it's so remarkable to manage to produce a good piece of literature at that age. The younger writers get lots of press and lots of attention, and it's deserved, I think.
So what are your goals in the future as a writer?
I'm working on another novel now, and I suppose I'm about halfway into it. And I intend to go on writing. At this point, it's what I do, and I can't imagine doing anything else. So, yeah. There will be others.
Well, it's one of the best things anybody can do, and you certainly got off to a good start with Extraordinary People, Paul Gervais. Very nice book. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.